Hello, everybody, and welcome to State of Our Workforce. My name is Michelle Wilson, and I am the Director of Evaluation and Learning at the National Fund for Workforce Solutions. As you know, each month on State of Our Workforce, we take a journey into the heart of workforce innovation and explore how to build an equitable workforce. And as we close out another year marked by constant change and rising demands in the workplace, we're choosing to do something a little different. We're taking a pause. Not the kind that adds one more thing to your list, but a real pause. The kind that lets you breathe, reconnect with yourself, and remember that sustaining equitable change requires tending to our own humanity. In this conversation, I'm joined by two people who have been powerful partners to the National Fund's own journey in this space, Mona Khan and Peter Goddard of the Social Identity Coaching Lab. They've coached us, challenged us, grounded us, and brought so much joy into the hard work of transforming workplace culture. Together, we explore what it means to cultivate peace and presence at work, why attending to culture is the key to meaningful change, and how we can begin to trust the expert within ourselves. And as you'll hear, Mona and Peter don't just talk about these ideas, they embody them. They invite us into practices that help us arrive fully, let go of old patterns, and reconnect with what makes us human. So, wherever you are, commuting, taking a walk, or settling in with a blanket like Peter suggests, this episode is your invitation to slow down. Take a moment. This is your pause. Join us. I am so excited about this conversation. Been looking forward to it for a while. So, guys, I get to talk with Mona Khan and Peter Goddard, and I just adore them. And this is like such a treat. So you're in for a treat. So I'm excited to be in this space. Hey, Mona.
Hi, Michelle.
Hi, Peter.
Hi, Michelle. It's good to be with you.
You as well. And Max is here rounding out the crew today. So let me just talk a little bit about Mona and Peter. We've been working with them at the National Fund for quite some time, and they have served in a role as coach, facilitator, wisdom seekers, truth hunters. I don't know. We can tag a whole bunch of names to the two of them, but do you want to just say a little bit about yourself and how you show up in the world?
You want to get us started, Mona?
Sure. So I'm Mona Khan. I identify as Desi or South Asian. Peter's joyful co-conspirator in this work. Born with an instant protest kit, as my father would say. I look at dessert first on a menu. I worked in international public health and a lot of social justice and human rights movements around the world and in the US. And what else? I am a third culture kid.
So I'm going to try out a new one on you, Michelle, because I usually say I grew up on an island in northern Vermont. But I was in conversation with someone last week and I realized I grew up on an archipelago in northern Vermont. So there's my geography term for the week. My dad and mom were small business owners. They ran the general store on that island and we lived upstairs.
Oh, wow.
I am the descendant of French Canadian farmers and Irish American teachers and also apparently general store owners. I am white, I'm Gen X, I'm queer, I live in Chicago. Chosen family is super important to me. I'm also the joyful co-conspirator of Mona Khan, which has been an absolute joy going on almost a decade. and the two of us get up to good trouble all over the place, trying to support organizations and movements and groups to bring some joy into their work.
Beautiful. Peter, does that place still exist? The general store?
The building still exists. And I think it's a bar. But my mom has pictures of this store existing back into the 1800s.
Oh, I'm just trying to figure out, like, is this a place that I can visit? I feel like I need to go there. Like, that's that.
While you're there, make sure to visit the library, which is about the size of the room
I'm
in right now.
Fantastic. So as I said, folks, you're in for a treat. Like, this is how we have conversations with Mona and Peter, and we get into some really meaningful, good stuff. So before we dig into our conversation today, I wonder, Mona, Peter, is there any kind of grounding you want to do for this conversation and how we bring folks in?
Sure. It was a delicious invitation, Michelle, that you offered in advance and said, if you want to bring a practice, something to help us get grounded, please do. And so Mona and I decided I would offer an abridged version of what we call the Resting with the Ancestors practice as a way to help us get started. This is a practice that's, well, it's meaningful to the both of us, and we realize it's become a fan favorite among different groups that we've worked with. There's a recorded version on our website that's a bit longer where we invite you to imagine a blanket and ask you to get cozy on the sofa. And so if anybody wants a 15-minute version to really ground themselves over the New Year season, feel free to visit our website. But here's a short version for today.
Blanket required.
And the blanket and the max, I think, really add to the vibe here.
Yes, we know.
So for those listening, I just want to invite you to settle in. And by that, I mean uncross limbs. Find a place where your feet can both be on the floor. Just feel what it's like to be in the body right in this very moment. That might be the sit bones on your chair, the back against the back of your chair. You might notice what it feels like to breathe in through the nose, for the chest to slowly rise and fall. Or any other energy that's alive in your body right now. Busy thoughts. Maybe there are places that feel especially free and open. Others that might feel tighter or more constricted. I'm going to offer some invitations, and I want to be so clear, there's nothing to do here. I want you to consider a loving ancestor, someone who would be an absolute champion, loving unconditionally. An ancestor can be a messy word for some people, so I want to be really clear. This might be somebody from your bio family, someone you're related to by blood. It could be a mentor, it could be a friend. Could be a cultural figure who shares one or more of your identities. Anybody who would be a big fan of you, I want to invite into your mind's eye. I want to invite you to imagine them standing right beside you or sitting right beside you. And to help you sense into their presence, maybe you could consider the sound of their laughter, maybe their posture or the way they sit, the way that they smile or some other characteristic expression on their face, maybe a signature scent, anywhere from perfume to fried onions or sweet cookies. Maybe there's a taste you can imagine, like tea that you share, or a sweet treat. Wow. once you've got a sense of this person with you, I want to invite you to imagine some really powerful, joyful, meaningful energy coming from that person towards you, enveloping you like a hug or like a warm blanket. And then just notice if there's some little message that this loving, caring ancestor has for you. It might just be a sense of an energy that has an emotion or a color or a texture associated with it, like happy yellow bubbles or a loving pink canvas. Or maybe there's some words or a phrase they used often if you've been together. There's no need to search here. Just allow whatever comes into your mind to come. And then before we close this abbreviated version of the practice, I want to invite you to thank this loving ancestor for showing up for you and thank yourself for being open. And then just wiggle fingers and toes or bring a little sway to the torso. And when you're ready, you can blink your eyes open and come back.
Mm. Yummy. So that's very beautiful, Peter. Thank you. I always enjoy that experience, but I can imagine folks in workforce development land are out there like, wait, what? What does this have to do with workforce development? What does this have to do with workplace culture? Let's talk about it. Like, let's talk about why a practice like this can be important and useful in the workplace.
Yeah. Mona and I are both coaches, so my immediate instinct was to say, Michelle, what do you think about that? So we can have a dialogue here, but maybe Mona and I can offer a few ideas to get us started.
I actually was thinking that was going to happen. I was like, this is very weird because I'm interviewing coaches, right? You've been in a space where you've coached me numerous times. And so, yes, that was, and I would have answered, well, Peter, like had to be. not my session.
Yes. Well, I mean, one of the things that comes to mind, and let's co-create here, Mona, if that sounds good.
Sure.
Michelle said, which questions feel most delicious to each of us? And I just happened to pick the first two. One thought that comes to mind is I'm a former manager of data analysts. And I can remember the first time I thought, you know, I've been to this leadership retreat and I had this really meaningful experience where they invited us to read a poem and then choose a line that stood out to us and then talk about it with someone else. And I was astounded by the sense of connection I felt to the person that I was speaking with. And so I brought that practice back to my team and I was sweating bullets because I thought, oh my God, these people are just going to think I've lost it. And in fact, it became sort of like people came afterward and said, can we do more things like that? Because it was a way of bringing our shared humanity into the room and creating space for joy and connection in jobs and in roles that were very technical and that sort of like creative and connective side wasn't always invited. And so I guess I start with that story as a way of saying, or as a way of answering your question to some extent, which is it's meaningful for anyone at work. It's meaningful for those in workforce development because it's a way of inviting the parts of us that tend to get left outside the door, into the room. And when those parts of us come into the room, we have access to our creativity. We have access to noticing things about ourselves and each other. And we both do better work and have a much better time doing it.
So this is about showing up as your authentic selves, and what I'm hearing you say, or mirror back, as you often say, bringing your whole selves into the conversation and what that allows you to do, right? Because you have access to more resources within yourself to address whatever you're doing in whatever workplace you're in, right? Is that an appropriate mirror?
Yeah, I think so. And I'm curious, Mona, what else is coming up for you in regard to Michelle's question?
Well, what came up immediately, and Michelle, you may have heard this from me before, and Peter has certainly heard this, because when I discovered her, and Audre Lorde as well, but when I discovered Pat Parker, I thought, where have you been my whole life? You know, and the quote, who's a healthcare activist and died of breast cancer many years ago. But, you know, the quote, the one that I really hold is, if I could take all my parts with me when I go somewhere and not have to say to one of them, no, you stay home tonight, you won't be welcome, because I'm going to an all-white party where I can be gay but not Black, or I'm going to a Black poetry reading and half the poets are anti-homosexual, or thousands of situations where something of what I am cannot come with me. The day all the different parts of me can come along, we would have what I would call a revolution. Mm. And that just, I can't read that without tearing up.
Yes.
Because I think from an early age, we are continually editing the parts that we hold because of outside norms, judgments, expectations, systems. And there's so much that can get lost. Yes. That we lose access to within ourselves. And so when we can co-create a space, a workplace, a family setting, whatever it may be, where all the parts of us can come along, our capacity to thrive, our capacity to be creative and generative, our capacity to connect, is off the charts, right?
Yeah. Well, so that kind of leads me into my next question around cultivating joy and attending to these, attending to workplace culture in a way that allows us to show up. So, I mean, just following in on that, right? And we often at the National Fund, and a lot of this, you all had a huge hand in helping us think through and talk about and find ways to create the space in ways that it feels right for our organization about how we want to show up in a space, right? Also shout out to Holly Marston, our network director, because she's also very good about this as well too, like creating the frame and intentionally naming joy as something that needs to be a part of the process. And again, I think sometimes concepts like these people don't necessarily think about in terms of workplace culture. But again, the intentionality around that and what it'll and what it gives you access to is huge. So can you say a little bit about how you introduce that to teams that you're working with, or how this shows up in your work and coaching, and say more about that? Mm-hmm.
Well, I would say part of why Mona and I work together, like both we do work together, and why I think we're great co-conspirators, is that we both have this natural attunement to joy, but not in a sort of toxic positivity way. Right? This sort of like sense of like, life is hard, and also like in any hard moment, would you like some joy? And our answer is typically yes.
Yeah.
So like part of the reason that we bring joy to the center of our work is It's fun. It's fun for us. It's fun for the people we're working with. And usually you don't bring in consultants like Mona and I because everything is going hunky-dory, right? Like there's a conflict that's hard or like something has changed in your context and it makes like how you've done the work until now not possible going forward. So you got to figure out how to work together in a different way. And it's much more possible to work through what's hard if you're carrying joy at the same time. And so that's one reason for us that we center joy is it's just fun. And also it makes things possible. Mona can speak to the nervous system impacts of this way better than I can.
For sure.
I tend to be the one who's like, let's do some embodiment practices. And Mona is the one who is more likely to say, let's bring in the neuroscience in order to help people understand why this
works. That is her jam.
But I'm going to steal a page from the Mona Khan playbook for a moment and just say, part of what makes joy amazing is it quiets the threat response. And so when we work in different organizations, what we notice is that fear is often the emotion that's getting in the way of teams being able to move forward and do their best work. Mm-hmm. Fear results from threat. And our nervous system doesn't know the difference between we're being chased on the savannah by a lion or through the forest by a bear, or that colleague just disrespected me and doesn't seem to see me for who I really am. It's like neurobiologically, the same response. And joy short circuits that fear in a way where we can get curious and actually connect with one another more deeply. Mm-hmm. And so we do all kinds of, you asked about the how as well. Like we do all kinds of crazy things from, there's rarely a meeting we don't open with music and we think really long and hard, mostly because we like it, about what kind of music will speak to the group that we're with. We have a whole list of connecting prompts that range from like, what was your favorite chocolate bar as a kid to, you know, what does liberation look like for you? We invite people to do embodiment practices like the one that we just did. We invite people to play. So like if you've got an arts and crafts kit at work, that's probably a good start. So that's what comes to mind for me in regard to what you asked, mm-hmm. Michelle.
So you just gave me a prompt for, one more neuroscience nerdy thing that I can think about. which is, you know, I think it's the hippocampus that's like sort of close to the amygdala, but it processes memory, right? So if you have a fear experience, the hippocampus is like processing that. And it's so now encoding or embedding in your brain as a memory and a learned experience with some wisdom about how to navigate that kind of an experience and what happens when you're experiencing fear. Same with joy, right? Yeah. So the practice, joy is a practice for us because life is hard and there's all kinds of shit that's going to come our way. And people are carrying all kinds of stress. And as Peter was saying, we like to think of ourselves as quite fun and quirky, but people don't bring us in for fun and quirky. They bring us in when there's something. Either they're thinking about like, how do we really transform our culture or some of the ways we're functioning, or we're in a crisis, or we're struggling with this issue, and how do we work through it, so on. And so when we can build that reservoir, right, so that people are able to work through fear, shame, and guilt, which is often where like equity work resides.
Yes, I was just gonna say that, yes.
Work. You know, as we've said to you, we do not believe growth happens from a place of fear, shame, or guilt. So if we can lead with joy and also hold what is hard, hold what may be toxic, then our ability to engage from a place of curiosity and empathy is much greater.
Well, I think also I'm thinking about one of the many instances where I've been in this space with you all, right? I'm thinking about, you know, a few years back when we started, when we really made a shift to dive into workforce equity as a signature piece of how the national fund shows up in the world. And that, I mean, it's inherently messy, right? When you think about equity, it's what we always say, like it, to your point, we, we aren't here. We didn't get here in a nice, polite way. It's hard. It's painful. It's ugly. It's nasty. It's dirt. It's all of those things, right? Like in how they show up, right? So to think that you come out of it, you move through this in a nice, clean, soft way doesn't make a lot of sense, right? Also doesn't mean that you need to be bashing folks over the head, right? Like, but what I appreciate about what you're saying is that like that joy can show up throughout the process in various different ways. And I'm thinking about a particularly challenging but really great meeting we had. And I remember feeling particularly beat up just by the experience, just because of what it required. But it was a beautiful meeting. And we, 7 o'clock in the morning, 6 o'clock, 6:30, 6:45, I don't know, I think it was like an ungodly hour for you all. You met me on the beach for a sunrise. Right. And we had a conversation and coffee, and we, you know, just kind of chatted and debriefed, and there was joy in that, right? And so how it shows up across the continuum of work is something that, you know, it's not like just at the beginning of the meeting or the end of the meeting or in the middle, but finding ways to create moments of joy as a reprieve too. I mean, I would imagine from difficult situations. I wonder what helps teams, what do you find helps that's helpful for teams in terms of letting go so that they can come into a space like this? Because, and I ask that question because like, so for me, being from Asheville, this woo-ness feels very good to me. Like, it's just like, yes, more of it. I'm really clear on that. But I think that may not always be the case for some other folks. And so if you're out there, you know, podcast land, you know, come on into the room. Yes.
You know, what we find when we come into a space with folks, or we're supporting them to come into a space together, there's a lot that feels hard to let go of, right? Mm-hmm.
Can I pause and just say that? Because I want to go back to something you said earlier around how people show up, like the fear and shame, like all of that.
Well, yes.
All of that comes into the space with you, right? And you've either been told this is not a place for this to show up, this is not a safe place, and what do you want me to do with that? And you're expecting me to let this go because you did a grounding practice with me, right? Like, that felt good. But all of that comes into the conversation, and it's mixing and commingling with everybody else who show up in a space like this. So I just wanted to say that because.
Yeah. No, it's complicated, right? It's layered. I mean, when Peter and I are co-designing something and preparing for something, there's so much we do around scenarios where we're sort of imagining different things happening, and we're being thoughtful about what are people carrying into the space. And we often do some preparatory work around that so we can really surface some of those stories and those experiences and those patterns so we can understand what are people holding. Mm-hmm. And what might help them to let go of old patterns, right? That might be getting in their way. And how might we support them to hold what's hard within them, whether it's fear or shame or guilt or a rupture or whatever it may be, and yet be able to engage? What do they need in order to be in a space together with others and have it be a generative experience rather than an extractive one? So I'm curious, Peter, let's co-create here. I have a, you know, as Peter mentioned earlier, you're not supposed to have a favorite child or favorite pet or whatever, but, this question, and there's another one we're likely to explore that just felt like, ooh, these are my favorites. I want to talk a little bit about letting go of patterns and how we help people stay connected.
Can I also pause and just say, for those of you who may be new to Mona and Peter, or to their style of coaching and how they show up in the world in this space. Like, this moment of co-creation in and of itself requires that you let go of a plan, right? To create new, right? And I think that is something that is a learned practice that feels very comfortable to us at the National Fund now, is the co-creating in the moment, right? Like in the shift. So I just wanted to name that, because that's also key to, I think, workplace culture, is the willingness to let go of this plan and accept another plan, or adopt or identify a plan. Mm-hmm.
Yes, it is. It's a kind of improv, isn't it? Right. And I didn't, Michelle, until you said what you just said, it didn't occur to me that actually what Peter and I are letting go of, and I am very much, if the world were according to Mona, I would be such a control freak. I mean, I you know, that's sort of part of like a other fantasy that exists somewhere in the recesses of my soma. But what we let go of is our plan. Meaning we're very thoughtful about how do we prepare so we can try and avoid rupture or harm of others, but really support people to engage in a creative and generative way. But we let go of our plan in service to those in the room. Like that. So that's, I think, again, this idea of what allows people to let go.
In service of the people in the room.
In service of the people in the room. So I think holding, if we stay, what we've always said is if we stay with our clients, if we stay with the people in the room, then it's hard for us to go back. We are really attuned. We are centered on honoring the people in the room.
What does it say about worker voice? I'm sorry. I'm just making some parallel. Like, but this is exactly it, right? This is this. Say that again, Mona. I need to hear it again.
We center ourselves. Our center of gravity are the voices of the people in the room. What they need, what they feel, what they're holding, what they dream about. So if we're asking them to get, as we say, brave and specific, to really try and notice and explore old patterns that might be getting in the way of their thriving, of their collaborating, of their being effective, then we need to hold that at our center, right? Mm-hmm. And so what we end up doing are things like we invite them to explore what's in need of repair, right? What is blocking their growth and their thriving? And what is there to celebrate? So it's not an either or, right? How do we understand these positive and problematic patterns? We cannot solve what we cannot name, right? So how do we work through them? We do things like we support folks to set the container for how to be and work together in times of crisis or transition. So for making space for, like, if you think of a marathon runner, okay, I don't know why I had that analogy, because I don't run anywhere. But anyway, the marathon runner is not just getting up and deciding to run 26 miles or whatever it is, right? They're figuring out that goo stuff that they need to nourish. They get the right shoes. They get the right clothes. They figure out a strategy to make the run and complete it. So it's the scaffolding of, okay, so how can we support folks to work through conflict? Let's set some agreements together for how we can do that in ways that feel meaningful. How do we want to communicate so that we can make space for multiple ways of thinking about this? How do we want to repair when we need to? So that's a sort of another, if we can provide some scaffolding, some supports in those ways that is co-created, then people are, I think, much more able to explore and let go of those patterns. Curious, Peter, what you would add?
I don't know that I would add so much as just add maybe as reframe a little bit of everything Mona said, and also. So Michelle, I heard you talking about like how might others help their teams do what Mona is describing. And we've done a lot of thinking in the last year about what have we learned together over the last 7, 8, 9 years. And we realized that there were a lot of things that were just implicit in how we were doing things. Many things are aligned with what Mona's describing, and they were just based on like all the professional experience we had, all the life experience we had before we started coaching and working together. We would approach problems based on what we knew. And so we've tried to distill what Mona's describing into how do we help others learn to be co-creators. And I think this skill of learning to let go of the plan is like the cornerstone skill. And I don't exempt myself from someone who had to go through a real hard learning process, because I come from a background where I think I was like 32 years old and somebody handed me a project and said, great, redesign the process for every school in Chicago to make a school improvement strategic plan. And I was like, you want me to do that? Like, this is nuts. And so I went through and did it in a very like linear, you know, command and control kind of way. And I've been in more than one conversation where the name of the plan we came up with is still in use in Chicago public schools. And I just want to hide under the table, or I just want to apologize profusely. Like, I'm so sorry I created this. I'm so sorry it's still in your life. Like, is there someone I could talk to? So that maybe you could stop doing that. And the learning of the magic of co-creation requires moving through that fear of, if we don't have a plan, if we're not clear where we're going, if things are going to change because of what other people think, and there's multiple perspectives in the room, so maybe the perspectives will just conflict and we'll get nowhere. Like, those fears are real and they're human. And so part of what we do as coaches to help other people learn to do what Mona described as how we try to approach the work we do with clients is really about like how to lean into the joy and the possibility of the co-creation and not the fear of, oh my God, what's going to happen if I let go of control?
So like this idea of the setting the container, again, another key piece, right? Because oftentimes if we're looking at all of these ideas or these concepts around like work with poise, authenticity in the workplace, you know, no shame, and all of those things that come into play, I have to imagine, because I've been in the space, that you have to, that there's some consideration for or how people think about the work, like so the container creates the safe space. But if you have an expectation of this and it's outside of the container and that container has not been set, that then adds to a negative experience, right? Like, so the importance of just kind of right, the responsibility, because part of the work in workplaces and workplace culture and how you show up and how you grow up in workplaces is everybody has responsibility in the space, right? And so how you show up in whatever space that you're in terms of setting that container can contribute to the health, the wellness of how someone or a coworker, colleague, employee, supervisor, supervisee moves through the work, or harm them, right? Does that make sense what I'm saying? And so the container setting part is so key, but I also don't think it's that easy for people to think about or do. I don't know. Maybe, I don't know. Pushback. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think there are a few different things. It's like, you know, we when we talk about sort of equity work, or, you know, we say racism is predictable, right? We can know how it's going to show up in different forms. Similarly, like organizational like the things that are likely to happen that get in the way of collaboration, that get way in the way of meeting goals, or that get in the way of people thriving. Mm-hmm. In their work or building trust, we have a sense of, right, of what those roadblocks mm-hmm. will be. And so if we can co-create the container rather than not say, here's the container, right, live with it, which erases people from the start, right, but co-create the container so it's grounded in the voices, the needs, the aspirations across multiple people. And you have some, you kind of seed the soil. Again, I don't know why I say this, because I know nothing about farming, but you seed the soil for shared ground, right? around conflict, around collaboration, around expectations, perhaps, or what have you, around how do we experience difference when we see something very differently. If we can co-create that, and then we practice those things, right? And we modify them, or we sort of move them, shift them as time goes on, and we learn from what works and what doesn't, it becomes what Peter and I call kind of no drama, you know? And so I'll give you an example of Peter and I have a practice where, and it sounds kind of hilarious to me, but we have had a conversation where one of us says to the other, "I feel kind of erased by what you did." And the other person said, "Can you tell me more?" Mm. Right? So think about the leap that had to happen. Mm-hmm. Right? It becomes a meaningful and efficient way, a no drama way, mm-hmm. to kind of go, okay, that's my amygdala's on fire, but I have a practice, right? Mm-hmm. It's like somatic practices, right? We have a practice that is embedded in our brain. So that's a go-to for when we're feeling a bit under threat. And that allows for a very different path for that conversation to take, where we can deepen our trust, deepen our connection, and really work through something together and learn from that experience.
So I'm going to back this up. This is normal, but I'm going to back this up because this example that you gave is a really beautiful example of saying, "I feel erased," right? Requires a level of safety. I don't know if there's anything to say about that, other than that also moves into the space of being brave and specific.
Mm-hmm.
All concepts that are deeply rooted in equity, right? If you're talking about doing this work, like, it's all really rooted in equity. But I'm curious, I just want to back up a little bit and just talk about identifying. We had this conversation in our prep meeting around who's the expert in this space, and how does it and how do you lean into your inner wisdom? And I think that's a great question to kind of think about before we go into the practices that individuals and organizations could dive into. But I wonder if there's anything that you want to say about what it means to cultivate this inner wisdom and these overlooked insights, especially when you're thinking about equitable systems. And we've said a lot too about how this is deeply rooted in equity, but is there any more that you want to say or tease apart in that?
Well, so I'd love to dive into, this is another one of my favorite, you don't have a favorite child or pet, but that's another of my favorite questions. But Peter, I'm curious because that, Michelle, you dropped this enormous bonbon, as you would say, in front of us around safety. And equity, and I just, Peter, can we engage
with
that?
Let's go there. Follow the yellow brick road.
Yeah, so here's the story that's like at the top of my mind, because, you know, we're giving a lot of examples, and like, there's nothing that makes people move into a fight, flight, or freeze mode, like saying we're going to have a conversation about identity, or we're going to talk about brave and specific conversation or how to move through conflict. But it comes to mind for me to just say, it's also not that complicated. Mm. My mom is 82, and I said I grew up, my parents were small business owners, and they sold that small business when I was 8. You can clearly see it's been a long time since I was 8. And she called the other day and she said, Joan Skelly has died. And I had to like run through the Rolodex. And she said, "That's the woman who taught you how to write in cursive." And this was a person who worked in their store as a clerk. And when it was slow, I would sit on a stool in the store and she would help me learn to write in cursive. And I just thought, wow, that's like 40 something years since this woman could have been in the organization that my mom and dad ran. And yet there's this like very human connection, right? Of like, I could remember who that was. My mom clearly remembered who that was. And I can think of similar people that have worked on teams that I've been a part of. And I can think of, you know, my husband worked for 25 years at IKEA. And we both had this conversation recently where we said, you know, the actual products that we created, the results we created as a result of our work, who cares? It's all about the relationships. And so partly like the boiled down answer I would give, and I'm really curious, Mona, like what stands out to you, but it just comes to me to say, like, when we value people, when we can keep in mind what we're really going to value at the end of the day, which is, did we live in integrity with our values and did we build meaningful relationships? These co-creation habits and these ways of being that we've described, it becomes very simple.
Yeah. I think what's coming up for me, because the word safety is so right, I have a visceral response to that word often. And I also have a visceral response to assume good intentions. My body does not like that phrase.
I wonder why.
I think part of it is, so when you talk about safety, equity, you know, one of the things that Peter and I are doing, and we take this really seriously, is we are asking people to take risks. So if we are asking people to take risks, then we want to make sure that we are being thoughtful about potential harm and how we can scaffold and support people to really bring their most generative selves to those conversations. And safety is one of the reasons, I think, that we typically will not work with an organization, and we work with organizations for multiple years. We typically won't work with an organization unless we are able to work with the executive team. And because they have an outsized impact, right, on culture, on what will get sanctioned and not, on whether your audio will match your video, right? Whether what you say will actually match what you do. And so I think that to really attend to, how do we support the leadership to really engage in this kind of commitment? And they often give us just extraordinary license, right? So how do we build trust with them, and how do we co-create with them so that it's a positive, meaningful, generative experience for everyone, but so that we are really reducing the likelihood that people will be sanctioned for the risks we're asking them to take.
I'm so glad you said that, because that's such a key piece of what we're talking about here in terms of where you start. Like, your entry point is so critical to that, right? So, you know, like, we're not just willy-nilly signing contracts and then showing up. All of it is very intentional from how you design it and who's in addressing all those spaces. So starting with the executive team is huge. You know, I could talk to you all forever, and I often do. But I want to just move into our closing question and think a little bit about, or hear from you about, simple practices that individuals or organizations can do to adopt, like, these sustained practices around reflecting on our workplace and workplace culture and how we show up and how they can bring that into the new year. But before I do that, I also offer you an opportunity. Is there anything, is there a loop you want to close or another area that you want to dive into, or do you want to just dig into that question? It's a yummy question.
It's a super delish question that speaks to sort of something I think that motivates Peter and I both at our core. So I wonder, Peter, how do you feel about me sort of talking about kind of the bigger issues or the concepts around kind of how we see this, and then maybe lean into some of the practices?
That sounds great. As somebody who likes dessert first, I'm surprised we didn't just skip right to this question.
I know. So, you know, you and Josh had posed this question of how do we rethink who the expert is, right? And cultivate our inner wisdom and connect to the oversights that might be overlooked otherwise. And what does that mean in terms of equitable systems and structures? This was like tres leches, like, for me. This is the most amazing dessert. So there are a couple of threads that came to mind for us. One is, in our experience, expertise starts inside. right? And most people have just been trained out of trusting it, right? So most people, including leaders, spend their whole careers kind of outsourcing wisdom to, quote unquote, the expert in the room. Not because they don't have insights and lots of wisdom and experience to lean on, but because systems have taught them not to, or to doubt what they know in their bones, right? Their truth. And I mentioned in our prep call, this photo of me, that of me as a young child, the hair is just going wild. The eyes are big, huge grin. And this, I mean, she's just, I am who I am. Here I am, world. I belong. And it's those parts of ourselves that we lose access to, right? Long before we enter the workplace, right? We've been sort of editing, right? Censoring, some things are visible, some things are not.
Or edited, right?
Or edited. And to the point where we lose sight, right, of our wisdom, of some parts of ourselves that are really integral to who we are. So our work begins by helping people feel seen, heard, and understood, right? And when they feel seen, heard, and understood, there's a sense of psychological safety. And then what happens is magic. They stop shrinking and they start not only accessing the wisdom they already carry, they're discovering it as well, right? So that's, I think that's another piece. Another, I think, important thought for us, or thread for us, is inner wisdom grows, our expertise grows when we lean into the body, right? When we can pause, reflect, before we can speak from a place of authority and agency, really taking in what's going on for us. So if I'm stepping up to make a speech and I'm holding the imposter voice, right? Attending to her can shape how I then show up, right? Or if I'm holding deep anxiety over a deadline, maybe that's not the moment to engage with a direct report on a really sensitive issue, right? So I think there's kind of, that feels really important to talk about. And then I think a final maybe thread is, what does this mean in terms of, because we talk a lot about self-work, individual, their clarity and their growth and their expression. But it doesn't mean anything unless they're in a system that makes space for multiple voices and multiple ways of doing things. You know, and Peter can go into some of the practices we offer to encourage that, but it's a magical combination. If people feel seen, heard, and understood, if they're really connecting to who they are fully and being able to express that, and they're in a system that can celebrate their voices, can take in multiple kinds of wisdom, you know, that's where I think organizations can be incredibly effective, thriving, and long lasting.
Yeah. And maybe just to sort of give people an entry point, right? Because these feel like, Mona, as I'm listening to you, these are like big asks of people, really. And often when folks are seeking to cultivate these skills, they have one-on-one coaching or they have us as partners in their organization. And that can be, usually is, a process of months and years for individual and systemic transformation. But at the same time, there are some really approachable ways to get started. We have a liberation toolkit that's on our website that we would invite people to look at that has approachable places to start with conflict, approachable places to start with how to have meetings that are fun and invite people to bring their full selves. And there's a whole series of meeting practices. There are somatic practices to sort of cultivate the kind of embodied energy that can help you hold space when things get tough. There are identity-based practices. There's like one of my favorites, just listening to you, Mona, is there's a playing with your professional drag practice that's all about like, what are those edited and editing parts of you? And like, which ones do you want to bring forward? So if anybody wants to like actually do that practice and send us a snapshot in your professional drag.
Michelle Rafferty and I are all on it. I'm just going to go ahead. Already off top, we're doing it.
So those are there. We'd invite people to check them out. And, you know, we have decided that meeting practices is absolutely the easiest place to get started. And so we've got a little, and we've been really working on kind of synthesizing what we've learned over the years in a way where we can help more people than just those we can coach. And so we're going to launch an e-course early in the new year that folks could get access to that really walks you through how to cultivate over the course of about a month some really healthy meeting practices that bring into an organization the kind of energy we've been talking about today. So if you hop on our website and subscribe to our Liberation Care Package, we'll let you know about it in the new year.
Fantastic. I just want to close with some observations that I've had over the years of having the pleasure of working with you all. One is around somatic practice. So many stories have popped up in my head, and we'll have to debrief them at another time, but around somatic practices. And I have seen over the years, people in our network be visibly resistant to it, right? Like eyes open, I'm not, arms folded. And like the next year or the next gathering, you see our arm drop. Or when Peter says, put your feet on the floor, you see them shift. You see it, you see it. And then they start asking for it. And I think the other one, again, around the space. So in yoga, one of the things a yoga teacher often says to students, she encourages people to use blocks, whether you need it or not, because the blocks are there to remind you that we are all worthy of support, right? And so it's not about whether or not you can touch your toes, but you are worthy of support. So take the block, right? Wherever you are in your practice. But folks like, I don't need a coach. I don't need this. And then being exposed to what it can be or how it can support them in their workplace practices. And then just kind of like, hey, do you remember when you offered that? I think I'm ready for it now, right? So like the evolution of that. And so I've seen that happen a number of times in our network in the times that we've been engaging with you all over the years. And so really appreciate that and seeing that. And so again, super grateful. This is a treat. Anytime I get to talk to Mona and Peter, it is a treat for me. So I'm so glad you agreed to be a part of this conversation. And really, really, we really wanted, Josh and I really wanted this to be a podcast. It's the end of the year. It's been a tough year. Just want people to like, you know, relax, listen to the podcast, think about, you know, reflect back over your year and think about what you can bring into the new year when you think about creating these spaces, these inviting workplace cultures where you can, workplace cultures. Yes, that is the word I want to use, where you can bring joy into the space.
Yeah.
As a part of it. But anyways, I thank you all. I'm super grateful for you. And so have a fantastic rest of the year.
Thank you, Michelle.
Thank you, Michelle.
State of Our Workforce is a production of the National Fund for Workforce Solutions. This episode was produced by Josh Enoch. The music in this episode is produced by Alex Productions. You can find past episodes of State of Our Workforce on our website at www.nationalfund.org. To stay updated on State of Our Workforce and all things workforce development, be sure to follow the National Fund for Workforce Solutions on LinkedIn. Don't forget to subscribe to our State of Our Workforce wherever you get your podcasts so you never miss an episode. We appreciate you tuning in and look forward to bringing you more valuable conversations in the future. Remember, everybody, life is tricky, so stay in your magic.